When Gary S. Becker was born in 1930, the Great Depression was only 1 year old. It had already devastated his hometown of Pottsville, Pennsylvania, a small coal mining community. From this environment, he would grow up to become one of the century's leading economists, and the one who most notably applied the science of economics to treating issues of social justice. Becker was raised in a close-knit patriarchal family. While his family was not wealthy, it instilled the values of hard work, learning, and a concern for the affairs of the larger world in which we live. Though neither of Becker's parents went beyond the eighth grade in terms of formal education, discussions of politics and justice were commonplace around the family table. This upbringing served Becker well throughout his life and eventually helped lead him to study the family as a fundamental social unit. When Gary Becker was still a child, his family moved away from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and Gary attended public schools in Brooklyn, New York. He excelled in the public school system and found his way to Princeton University, where he graduated in only 3 years. Becker decided to pursue graduate studies at the University of Chicago, where, under the influence of Milton Friedman, he realized that economics was not an abstract discipline, but one that could be directly applied to the social issues of the time. Taking his doctorate in 1955, Becker little realized that he would eventually become the recipient of a dozen honorary doctoral degrees. His dissertation, Applying Economic Analysis to the Subject of Racial Prejudice and Discrimination, went on to become his first book, published in 1957. Now, with a wife and a young family of his own, he left Chicago for New York, dividing his time between Columbia University and the National Bureau of Economic Research. He remained at Columbia for 12 years, and in 1964, published his seminal work, Human Capital. The book would prove to be a turning point in the development of economic theory and one of Becker's most important contributions to the field. When his wife died in 1970, Becker returned to the University of Chicago and widened his application of economic theory to a study of the family. His application of the rational choice economic model to problems typically addressed by other social sciences later led to a joint appointment with the sociology department. In 1980, he married Middle East historian Gidi Nashat, who shares his interest in the causes of economic growth and in the role of women in economic and social life. In 1985, Becker took the unorthodox step of writing a monthly column for Business Week magazine. He found this discipline extremely useful, as it forced him to recast his powerful ideas for a lay audience without the benefit of technical language or a blackboard full of complex calculations. In 1992, the world caught up with Gary Becker. As a result of his lifelong commitment to applying fundamental economic concepts to a wide range of human activities and persistent social problems, he was awarded the Alfred Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Becker's economic analysis has extended to the development of human capital, the economics of the family, the analysis of crime, discrimination, habits and addictions, the formation of preferences, price theory, and population growth. Liberty Fund welcomes you to a series of three conversations with Professor Gary Becker, in which he is joined by three different colleagues for a wide-ranging discussion of some of the most important aspects of his work. In our first conversation, Professor Becker discusses changes in the economics profession over the years and his role in extending economic analysis beyond its traditional areas of concern. Professor Becker is joined in this conversation by Edward Glaser, professor of economics at Harvard University.
The common view, I think, in the profession is that economics over the past 50 years has really changed radically. In 1950, so the common view goes, economics was defined by its subject matter. It was about markets, it was about currencies, it was about well-defined transactions involving cash. In 2002, you know, I was just up until 2 a.m. in the morning studying hatred, and mm-hmm. I'm not uncommon for an economist. Yeah. So we've changed really from being a field about subject to being a field about methodology, to being a field about approach. And of course, you know, certainly the general view is that you were the, you know, the great figure moving us along that change. But before we get into your role in this, how true is the common view about what 1950 was like? I mean, if we go back 50 years ago, right, to what extent is that sort of view that it was not about methodology, it was about subject matter? Is that true?
I think it is largely true. I came into Chicago as a grad student in 1951. And the field of economics at that time was mainly devoted to what I would call traditional economic subjects, supply and demand for different products and services. Stock market a little, there wasn't really much systematic analysis of stock market, some macroeconomic type of policy. Keynesian economics was already in place then, so there's a lot of discussion of macroeconomic policies, international trade policies. The basic theory of international trade was already established. But if you ask what was the scope of economics, it was extremely limited. And when people began to work on questions that broaden that scope, they were said to be doing not economic type of work. I mean, by the leading figures in the economics profession.
But not Smith, right? I mean, when Smith talks about this stuff, it's the same economic lens being turned on.
Absolutely.
On everything.
Smith was different. Smith and many other of the classical economists took a very broad view of economics and used similar reasoning. That vanished as the field became more technical and refined. And with each technical step, it became narrower and narrower.
Right. I mean, your dissertation, The Economics of Discrimination, is, of course, you know, really, I mean, it's a seminal work. It's a seminal work on the fusion of novel preferences and the market. Mm-hmm. And what's so remarkable about it is it's not just about, you know, people discriminating each other. It's about how that's going to actually happen in a market. Mm-hmm. In a market transaction. I think actually a lot of modern work on behavioral economics actually just focuses on the unusual preferences,
right,
and actually doesn't ask how that's going to actually
Absolutely.
Play out in a market.
Well, I think, you know, I think I got the topic originally from something Milton Friedman had said. I can't remember all the details. And then I went home and started thinking about discrimination. I think he set some problem in discrimination. I went home and I started thinking about it, and I came up with the idea of a discrimination coefficient. That was excited me greatly because I felt now I had a handle to discuss this problem. The next thing I wanted to do, and you're absolutely right about that, was to see how market forces affected the distinction between what I called the taste for discrimination and market discrimination. And I think if there's a main theme of my book, it's that you cannot go easily and automatically from one to the other, that there are many forces that will influence how individual tastes for discrimination play out in the market. And so I try to do that as best I can, bring in, you know, monopoly, competition, consumer-level choices, and government. I even have a little two-page discussion of, you know, how government will influence the amount of discrimination.
I actually agree with you that to me, at least, the most special thing about your thesis is the fact that the taste for discrimination doesn't necessarily work out one for one to discrimination. That the presence of, you know, just a few non-discriminatory entrepreneurs can actually mean that, you know, the impact of wildly discriminatory entrepreneurs is totally muted.
Absolutely.
But the thing that guys remember most about this, which is clearly related to thinking about this in a market setting, but it's a little bit different, I think actually ultimately, you know, less seminal than the other insight, is the fact that discrimination is in a sense costly. Right? So the thing that if you ask most graduate students what they remember about the economics of discrimination, it's that you know, having discriminatory tastes actually, you know, in carries a cost. And when you think about it, it's obvious that maximizing cash is going to bring you more cash than maximizing cash subject
Absolutely.
To a discrimination constraint or subject to a taste for discrimination. How surprising was that in the time? How surprising was this insight?
Well, it's hard for me to know. I people didn't really bother to think systematically about discrimination, either in economics or in sociology, any other field.
But there was this thing that sort of discrimination was a conspiracy of businessmen or
the
to
Marxists
increase profits
had
or something.
There was some. I have a number of references to the Marxist literature. Yeah. That was a conspiracy theory that capitalists discriminated in order to keep down and extract some more rents from the workers. That was a Marxist theory, and I have some quotes in it where it's very blatant, very open about what it was. So they had paid some attention to it. If you look within the economics, I remember when I was telling Milton Friedman about the work on discrimination, his initial instinct was to rebel against it, because he had suffered a lot, he felt, from discrimination, which I'm sure he did in the 30s and so on. He had difficulty getting jobs and so on.
Right.
And so when I said, well, you know, discrimination is a preference, you have to look at how it operates in the market, he didn't like that cold, you know, way of analyzing. But very shortly, he saw, yeah, this seems to be the right way of doing it. He was one of my strongest supporters and was on my dissertation, was a very strong supporter of what I did. So I think, you know, people, economists didn't think about it very much. Marxists did, but they weren't in the mainstream of economics. Sociologists didn't think, of course. And I think what I try to do is say, yes, discrimination is a preference. It has a cost. You have to give up something. And people might be willing to give it up, but how their willingness to give it up versus the entry of people with different willingnesses, the conditions under which people can enter, either through open competition or indirect competition by buying out a monopolist or through the political process, mm-hmm. All that is relevant. But the fact that it is a cost means that if you have a open competitive system, that's going to reduce the amount of discrimination that you will see. And so if free market people like that implication of it, I think it's a correct implication, but they like that implication, that markets sort of cut into discrimination. I think there's a lot of truth to it. Now, the problem is, I made the point, and I still believe it's a correct point, that yes, it cuts into it, but there's no reason to believe that markets will eliminate discrimination. It may make it less than it would be. You have more competition as opposed to monopoly. I show under some condition you're going to get less discrimination. All that's relevant, but that doesn't mean you end up with zero discrimination.
What's your take on the changes over the past 40 years in black-white relations? I mean, there's been a sort of a stunning combination of both, I would say, an elimination of overt racism to a certain extent. On the other hand, obviously, there's been a degeneration in many of the inner cities, and many of the lives of African Americans are not any better than they were 50 years ago. How much do you think that, you know, what do you think your thesis has to tell us about this 50-year change? Mm-hmm. How do you think we can understand it better with the tools that you gave us?
Well, that's a good question. It's a tough question. What I think I did and helped contribute was bring to the economists the attention that issues like black-white differences, male-female type of differences, and other sort of differences are, number one, they're very important in the economy. Number two, economists have something to say about it. Now, these are very obvious statements, but that was considered, you know, heretical, some unacceptable. When I went up, I was a young guy, went up to MIT, and I was sort of on the job market halfway, and Bob Solow, who was there, was one of the rising stars in the profession, and Bob asked me what was my thesis. I said, on discrimination. He said, I thought I was a neoclassical economist. I said, I am. I said, but I think this is part of neoclassical economics. And he wouldn't accept. I mean, you know, he was polite, but he didn't accept that this was a part of neoclassical economics. I'm not sure he still accepts it, to tell you the truth. But that was clearly one of the top people, a young mm-hmm. person, but one of the top people in the field. That was the perception of the field. So to make economists believe and comfortable with the notion that discrimination is important, we can say something about it, it's relevant, we can talk about occupations, we can talk about earnings, whether it's blacks, whether it's Jews, whether it's women versus men, whether it's Chinese, whatever group, you know, we're referring to, homosexuals versus not. This was, I think, a very important contribution, not only of me, but everybody else working in this area. Now, what does that contribution lead to, you're saying?
In terms of understanding the last 50 years.
In terms of understanding the last 50 years. I think, you know, I wouldn't want to say how much influence it's had over public policy in these areas, because I don't really know whether it's had a significant influence or whether, you know, the growing power of blacks, growing political representation, led to civil rights laws of various types, and, you know, still debate over how much influence they had on some of these things. I think they had some influence. Mm-hmm. How much, I don't know. I think it led, if I had to say it on a more practical basis, to a couple of things that maybe is of some importance in understanding the changes in the last 50 years. And there I'll bring in some of my later work as well as the discrimination work, because I don't think, mm-hmm. I think they're very much interrelated in a sense. I was led to from one into the other. I think we have a greater appreciation for the importance of human capital formation and how that maybe it interacts with discrimination, but is an important force in the lower earnings of blacks, lower occupations of blacks, lower earnings of women, lower occupations of women. That somehow, if we want blacks to rise up in the economic hierarchy, we have to be worried about what kind of education they're getting. Are we discriminating against them in access to schools? Are they getting a good quality education that will prepare them? What's their family structure? What kind of backgrounds are they getting? Are they already by age 16 have fallen so far behind that they're condemned to have a lower economic position? Now, that's not just the taste for discrimination, not just that model, but it's that, it's human capital, it's family. And I see all these things as related. They're different subjects I had worked on, other people worked on, but I was partly led from my discrimination study to the study of human capital by the evidence I have in the book of the substantial differentials in earnings both among blacks and among whites by education category. Those are data I have in one of my later chapters that I analyze a little bit, but I was very conscious of those data, and I just, when I was going to go to the National Bureau, I made it a point to say, well, this is something I'd be worth working on, how to explain those differentials. So, and I think that has contributed to the understanding. Now, can the analysis help us understand why violence increased, crime rates increased, the family broke down even more so among blacks than among whites? I don't think discrimination book alone, and that's where a lot of the pathologies have come. I don't think discrimination book alone will help us appreciate that. I think that plus some of this later literature of mine and others, I think does throw a lot of light on those questions.
You, in the introduction to your Economics of Human Behavior book, you give the three main aspects of the economic mm-hmm. approach as being maximizing behavior, which, you know, is maybe a little bit more precise than just people demand less when prices fall. I mean, that's mm-hmm. sort of the heart of that.
Right.
And market equilibrium, mm-hmm. Which of course is related to, you know, supply curves going up and free entry. Mm-hmm. And the last is stable preferences, which at some point in time, actually, in this talk, I should come back to, because it's hard for me to understand why stable preferences were such an important assumption. I mean, it's sort of when I read the verbiage around the stable mm-hmm. preferences line, I sort of get the sense that you basically wanted to stop a lot of ad hoc theorizing. It wasn't that you particularly wanted, mm-hmm. were committed to the mm-hmm. idea that preferences were always stable, but you just didn't like the idea that people would always say, oh, you know, there was more bread demanded on Tuesday because the preference right. for bread went up during that day. I mean, is that a fair characterization of what was going on there?
I think that is fair, yeah. It was a methodological constraint. I wanted to I wasn't saying what I wanted to do. I'd say the good economics that I know did that. And I said the advantage of doing that was you tied your hands to prevent these ad hoc explanations that were dominant in the economics as well as in other hmm. subjects. And I give a couple examples in that introductory essay that, you know, if there's an increased demand for meat, we don't explain it by price and income, there's a taste for meat went up. Well, that's pretty vacuous. It didn't have any analytical concept or cut or scope the way maximizing and equilibrium do. They have precise implications about behavior.
If I think about sort of the, forgetting about the stable preferences, if I think about maximizing people and market equilibrium as being sort of the two pillars, mm-hmm. I think of two of your earliest essays, both your dissertation and your wonderful paper on irrationality and economics behavior, which has always been one of my favorites, is really being about markets. So irrationality is not at all about preferences. It says in many cases preferences are utterly irrelevant, make the guys random, make the guys totally covered by inertia, but you still get downward sloping demand curves and upward sloping supply curves. So that's really about markets, and not very interested in you know, in preferences. But then somehow or other you had a switch, and the next set of things, fertility, human capital is more complicated, but these really focused on the consumer. It really didn't, there's in your 1960 essay on fertility, there's not really a lot about the market there. Prices are taken in some sense, I mean, as exogenous. A lot of it is just thinking about what the real prices for things are. So it's sort of, you know, saying that demand is going to be a function of what price is, and then how do we think about price properly in these areas when we're away from cash prices? Is that a fair characterization?
Well, you have to go back a little bit in time to the fertility stuff. Just talking about fertility in the sense of price and income was anathema to most people who worked on fertility. And when I gave this paper, as I recollect in one of some places where I've written, and I said, I'm going to treat children like a consumer durable, the whole place broke out laughing. And there was about 60 people. This was at a conference. And then I went into price and income, and that just way of looking at it, people found very objectionable. That was treating children like a commodity, like a good, you know, children were really different, and so on. So I felt to go that far, it's true, I didn't really get into markets, but to go that far and to talk about price and income was about all I could do at that point because of the enormous objections to that approach, and I just tried to put forward the view that we could explain a number of the things that we see about fertility, including the business cycles. I had a little National Bureau business cycle chronology analysis in there that this would help us in understanding that. And that's basically where I ended it up with.
So if there was so much hostility towards, you know, your theory of fertility, that the price of time, the price of children determines how many kids people have, what would your opponents have said determines the level of fertility? What was their explanation? It was just random? What was their explanation of what determines how many kids people have?
You have to realize that there was no systematic model of fertility choice that was the big competitor. The demographers didn't like theory in general, so they would just want to study carefully, as they did. It was very careful quantitative analysis. The sociologists would say it was things like what other families were doing, social forces would determine it. Now, where they came from and how, you know, to introduce them in a systematic fashion. That wasn't their strength, so they didn't do that type of stuff. The psychologists would determine, you know, what children does for a woman's psyche or a man's psyche, things of that type. And so there were bits and pieces of alternative theories, but there was no systematic theory. That's the reason why I thought that this sort of theory, whatever its limitations was, it did say about certain things a very precise implications about them, and therefore could carry us a considerable distance.
You know, as I hear you talk about sociology and economics, the role of peer effects, social interactions, connections with others, I think economics has done a very strong job at integrating those sorts of effects. And you've certainly been, you know, as I have, involved in that movement, and that I think has melded quite well, and actually been productive in lots of different ways. The psychological insights, and I want to differentiate them from the things that are behavioral economics, but let's say in the context of kids, actually thinking about the preference for kids, the taste for kids, as opposed to really your essay, which is really about the price of kids, and your identification comes off of changes in the price of kids. The demand side, I think not only economists by and large aren't very good at describing where that demand side comes from, but it's not very obvious that the psychologists have added that much to us. So if I sort of think about this, the giant lacuna to me is just we don't really understand very much where demand comes from for kids or for most other commodities for that matter.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, there is an alternative theory, it's the biological theory that's based upon that people want to reproduce themselves, and there's fitness, and that's a theory of choice. I think it's a theory that I believe is unsuccessful in explaining modern behavior, but it is a theory, and it's a very different mm-hmm. theory. It has something in common. You can put it in a maximizing framework. It's a very different theory. I think we're still struggling to find out where preferences come from. Traditionally, economists said, well, it's not our goal to talk about preference. There it comes from psychology, it comes from sociology, maybe biology. But we take that as given, as division of labor in science, and they handle that. I've been, along with others, have been dissatisfied with that. I think we can say something about preferences. We have to start someplace, right? So we're not starting with nothing. But we can tell something about how preferences get shaped, say, by parents over children, by institutions like schools over children. I have a paper which is still working on what I call indoctrination, how schools and religions indoctrinate people into various attitudes and so on. People know that. They're not being stupid. The question is the interplay between knowing that and willingness to do it. So they're not going to willingly do that if they lose utility. And so we can develop that theory. Well, we have a theory about how people's attitudes towards smoking get affected by smoking or maybe other activities, life cycle events. So I think economists are social forces, peer pressure, your friends smoke, you smoke. I think we're moving in that direction. And I think the right way for us to move in that direction would be, of course, to bring in social influences and also bring in a recognition of people that certain actions they take now will affect what their future preferences will be like, including what friends they get, what neighborhoods they live in, and things of that type. And that, in a sense, people end up choosing their own preferences within the limits of where they come from, what they inherit from their parents, their incomes, and so on. And that gives us a partial theory of the formation of preferences.
Okay, so we start off in with you making a very strong stand in favor of stable preferences, which I think we understand as being really a fight against ad hoc preferences, not a fight against a solid economic model preferences. And then I've always interpreted your first paper that really changes that really attempts to model the formation of preferences or investment preferences as the addiction paper. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the addiction paper, which, you know, thinks about people's decisions of how much to consume of, you know, cigarettes or alcohol or whatever as affecting future preferences. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly that's the nature of addiction. And that's obviously been a very mm-hmm. exciting and influential mm-hmm. paper that I think adds a lot to our understanding of addiction. And there it's very clear to me, your earlier point about individuals investing in their own preferences, clearly that's dead on. Individuals mm-hmm. are going to make a decision about how much to smoke, taking into account future decisions. Your paper with Casey on investment in patience, mm-hmm. Where you specifically look at, you know, individuals attempting to make investments that influence how patient they're going to be, mm-hmm. harder for me to understand what that's actually explaining, and in the sense that I believe very strongly that parents invest in patients for kids. I'm perfectly willing to believe that schools invest in patients. It's less obvious to me, at least, you know, gauging from introspection, that I've ever done anything that really looks like investing in patients. I've invested in learning skills or in, you know, things with intertemporal complementarities, but that's harder for me. Why did you decide to focus on individual investment rather than, say, just looking at the parental problem, which is also an equally, you know, rich and
I don't exclude the parental investment from that process. But I do think people do take some actions in order to make themselves more patient. So people partly train themselves to try to consider the future consequences of what they're doing as opposed simply to the present, so that they do not simply take a pleasure now and neglect the future. And it's one of the points that people make. Criticism of the addiction paper, I would think of it as more a way of adding some additional aspects to it, was that people, when they become addicted, they lose that capacity to some extent to trade off present for the future, so they become much more future-oriented. Their discount rate, whether it's hyperbolic or exponential, that's not important for this issue, but the discount rate, you know, gets lower. And And they have to try to overcome that. And they try to overcome that in a variety of ways. And I think, so yes, parents try to make their kids more aware of the trade-off between present and future. There's no question about that. Little children have a great deal of difficulty in making that trade-off. And so they teach them that. But I think adults have that problem as well. They're not enjoying school, and they try to keep themselves well, but look, I have to try to be aware of the benefits that are going to come in the future. Now, to me, that's partly trying to say, let me not discount those benefits too strongly, that they're not simply trying to measure what those benefits are, but not to try to discount them. But why do we write that paper, you might say? Well,
why did you choose that tack?
What interested me was, and I think Casey, was the fact that we observe certain systematic differences in discount rates. Higher income people often claim discount the future less than lower income people. Now, one story for that is that people become higher income because they discount less. But is that the whole story? I'm not convinced it's the whole story. Systematic difference by education. It said that more educated people discount less. Okay. Maybe the school is what does it, but do people take that into account when they decide on the school they're going to? And then they're partly making that choice. And there are a variety of other differences. It said that inner city people, Ed Banfield, your former colleague before he passed away, wrote this book on the unheavenly city,
absolutely.
As you know about that, which is a very strong emphasis on the low, heavy discount rate in the urban. Where does that come from?
He's huge on the relationship between status and discount rate. This is a huge Banfield point in this book.
So the idea was that maybe we can explain some of these, instead of just taking them as given, which is what economists typically do, maybe we can explain them. That was the motivation. And then it seemed there was a simple way of doing it. That paper's annoyed a lot of people, but so was the addiction paper. So maybe it's on the same footing as the addiction paper. But I think we made a little progress in trying to endogenize and explain this heterogeneity. And that's the goal, at least, to explain right. This heterogeneity in discount rates.
One thing that's been really troubling me is, given the massive change in economics that you've played such a leading role in, given the extent to which economics is about the family, is about crime, is about, why do we have different disciplines of economics, political science, and sociology anymore? Don't we need to rethink these divisions that were carved out a century ago and reorganize the American Academy in a way that takes account of the fact that all of these disciplines have changed and none of the existing barriers make really any sense whatsoever?
Well, in a sense, we have changed the division, even though we haven't changed the disciplines. I think we now have a lot of economists working on sorts of things and maybe doing sorts of things that sociologists would have done 20 years ago. Now they're using maybe better tools and not only theory but statistical analysis, etc. But they're doing things that sociologists would have done. I think one of the problems in sociology in attracting the type of people like Jim Coleman and Marty Lipson and some of the Bob Merton and others is that people wanted to work on sociological type problems in their generation went into sociology. Now they can go into economics and do it with better preparation. So I think there has been an erosion. Economists do political economy, politics, economists do sociology. I think we're going to see more in the future. You may have these departments remaining, but there'll be people trained in economics, will be in political science departments. We're already seeing some of that in different places. You don't see much of that in sociology, but you may begin to see more of that in sociology when we can overcome the hostility of many sociologists to economics.
Great. This has been terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed, for tough questions, good questions.
It's fun.
In our second conversation, Professor Becker addresses the relationship between law and economics. As society seeks a balance between the cost of deterrence, enforcement, and punishment, and tries to reconcile these needs with its finite resources, Gary Becker has worked to place the study of crime and punishment within an economic framework. The conversation also turns to the subject of interest groups and how economics can help us understand their role and influence in the political process. Professor Becker is joined in this conversation by Judge Richard A. Posner. Judge Posner serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit and is a senior lecturer in law at the University of Chicago Law School.
So, Gary, you know, law has changed a great deal in the last 40 years. Much more emphasis on economics, particularly in scholarship, but, you know, also in the courts and in Congress, administrative agencies. So how do you see this development, and what role have you played in it?
Well, I think I played a really small role in that. I think you played the major role in it. I think the development is a healthy development. A lot of the legal issues dealt with are issues that are economic issues in a broad meaning of the term economic, whether it's torts or divorce law or criminal law. These involve the use of resources. And I think prior to the introduction of economics into this area, the legal scholars and judges didn't have a framework, a powerful framework, under which they could bring to bear an analytical apparatus to discuss problems other than just, you know, following precedent to try to understand the sources of precedent and, in new cases, the type of reasoning that would be relevant to where the precedent wasn't such a clear guide. So I think economics provides that, as it does in a lot of other areas. In the area of crime, where you know, I've worked, where maybe I had a little bit of a contribution, there it seems it was a natural area to provide a framework in which the criminal was more rational. They were making calculations, or at least acting as if they made calculations of whether this was a good activity to be a thief or a robber as opposed to going into some legal activity or a drug dealer. And the society had to respond to that. And what I assumed in my own analysis, society responds rationally. So I tried to work out some criteria for what would be rational response to by society, taking account of the fact that criminals are affected by deterrence. So criminals are less likely to go into crime if they're punished or if they're caught and then punished. But they're also less likely to go into crime if legal opportunities open up, if their education is better, if jobs are more available. So people have a misunderstanding that the economic approach to crime is hard. It's just law and order, punishment, and so on. It's that, and that's not unimportant. I think it's quite important. But it also says that crime is affected by whether we provide good education for potential criminals, whether we make the opportunities available to them in a legal market so attractive that, given whatever law and order we have, they don't want to enter into crime. And I think the economic framework is an excellent framework for that. And I think, despite all the criticisms, it has overwhelming dominance now, both implicitly in what people, judges and others, did in the past, but certainly explicitly now in a lot of the analysis.
No, I've heard you say that you think economic analysis of law, you said this a few years ago, had maybe plateaued, what do you mean exactly?
What I meant by that, and I think I remember saying also, this is not unique to law. I think this happened in labor economics, happens in all fields that I'm familiar with, that when a field gets created, there's enormous excitement in the field because a lot of new ideas are being introduced. It happened certainly in law. I mean, it revolutionized the field. It happened in labor economics, enormous change in the field. So new theories come in, and some fields, like labor, a lot of empirical work comes in. The theory interacts with the empirical work, and it moves ahead maybe for decades. And that's what happened in law, I think, in law and economics. But after a while, what happens in all fields is that this initial burst, maybe reinforced by a subsequent burst, begins to reach a plateau because the new ideas have been worked out and nobody has come along with corresponding new ideas. So there's a period, sometimes a long period in each field, of a mopping, what I call a mopping up operation. So if you look at the crime area, Well, people say, well, let's take this variation on the punishment system. And let's introduce this form of heterogeneity. And I can name names, but I won't name names of people who've make a living of it. That's okay. It's not an unuseful activity. But it, you know, it's not going to lead to any dramatic, really, changes in it. And I think that's happened in the field of law and economics. It certainly happened in the field of crime, the criminal side of law. And to the extent I'm familiar with other fields, my impressions happened there, too. Now, sometimes it happens in every field. Sometimes it's happened in physics, people say, in small particle physics. Sometimes it's delayed because the theory leads to empirical work. The empirical work brings up new regularities, and that pushes stimulates the theory. I made the claim then, maybe wrong, that one of the problems in law and economics is too many, particularly the economists who worked in that field, were pure theorists. They didn't link it up closely enough to the data. And the data could be court cases. I don't mean, you know, the sort of regression stuff that economists will do in labor. It could be a variety of forms of data. And that when you link a theory to the data, you make the theory, you make the field much more robust, you delay this period of transition. I think one of the problems I've thought in the law and economics field is, aside from you and Bill Landis and a few other people, a larger fraction of people went into that field compared to, say, in labor economics, were theorists. And I think when you get theorists talking to other theorists, that's the beginning of sterility for a field until you get somebody who comes along and links it to some observations.
How does an economist, and this is, of course, very important in law, how does an economist deal with people whose careers have been designed in such a way as to minimize incentives in the ordinary sense? So judges, all judges are paid the same. You know, you can't get a raise by being a good judge. You have life tenure. Or jurors, they're brought in. They can't be punished for being lazy and falling asleep and giving goofy results. So can an economist say anything about the behavior of these? I mean, the professors have tenure, but you know, they can get higher salaries or they can write books and so on. But how does an economist deal with people where it seems that the object is to strip them of incentives?
Well, I mean, economists can deal with it. The questions that one would ask would be, of course, are there any other incentives that you can provide people? Somebody who becomes a judge usually is giving up, or at least often is giving up, greater income that they could make in private practice. So they always like this activity, okay? And they get hope. They're not doing it simply because they can rest and they don't have to do any work. Their clerks can do it. Some of them maybe is in that capacity, but they like the power, the responsibility, the opportunities, whatever would come in that. And therefore, you know, they're still, economists say, they're still maximizing. It isn't a monetary income, they're maximizing. Now, how do you create good incentives for people in that?
How do you understand their behavior? Yeah, suppose they're maximizing, you know, prestige and leisure and some intrinsic interest in the job or power or deference or so on. But how does one, isn't that kind of empty? It doesn't tell you how they're going to decide.
Well, no, but we can deal often. You know, consumers don't maximize money, but We look at changes in costs of engaging in various activities, and I think that's what you want to do with judges. So let's say you take away all the clerks of judges. How much time will they put into it? What kind of effort would they put into it? This would be one type of implication on it. A judge might be overturned on review. Now, is that going to affect them? Well, that will depend upon, you know, how, if that's part of the maximum, then you would say, if a judge is embarrassed by being overturned, this is a sign that they're a bad judge if they keep getting overturned, and this is a value, then you would predict if there's a greater tendency, your cases, a certain type of cases which you think are likely to go and be reviewed by the higher court, and therefore you might be overturned. You would predict different decision making then, maybe for cases where you know nobody's going to bother to look at these cases, they're too insignificant or whatever the criterion are for that. So that would be another implication you would get. Would it make a difference when whether the judges run for office or whether they're appointed? Some states judges run, some they appoint.
Most actually. There's some form of election for most states.
Yeah, okay, so that you examine that. Some crazy economists have suggested that even federal judges should only have a fixed term.
Right? Yes, I know.
Would that make a difference if they had 14-year, maybe renewable terms, but 14-year terms, the way the Federal Reserve officials have, as opposed to lifetime, which is in the Constitution, right? So it makes it harder, to analyze it. But I don't think it makes it empty. I think you can get implications out of it, because the thing that economists have going for them, that the economic approach, I should say, it's not just economists, but the economic approach has going for it, is that people are maximizing. And once people are maximizing and doing it in a consistent fashion, then you have implications about their behavior. And sometimes you have a rich set of implications, sometimes they're more limited, but you always have some. You can make it non-tautological, and you can make it interesting. And I think in all these areas, you can get interesting implications out about the behavior, whether it's judges or other people in criminals or anybody else you're referring to.
Well, Gary, speaking of these public sector people like judges, when you started writing about politics in the 50s, you were kind of a Schumpeterian, believing that we have a potentially ruling class, the members of which compete with each other for votes, which are like, sales, purchases by consumers. And then later, your emphasis shifted to interest groups. So what explains that shift?
Well, I began to think that voting was, models of voting were not the right way to approach the political process. Even though we all vote, and obviously decisions.
Some of us vote.
People
half
vote,
us.
Half the population votes, and majority wins, and as in the Bush-Gore contest.
Not
the majority, but the majority of electoral votes, or whatever. An old idea that people's incentives to vote for their interests are very weak because they don't have any influence. And so under the impetus of work being done by people like George Stigler in particular and others, I began to shift my attention to the role of interest groups. They, I thought, were more fundamental in the political process, whether you had voting or not, that they would be relevant in a non-democratic government as well as in a democratic government. They are relevant in a non-democratic government as well as in a democratic government, and that they will buy votes, not literally go out and buy them, but by influencing how people vote through advertising, propaganda, campaign contributions, and the like. And that, therefore, the right way to understand the political process is if we can get a good understanding of how which interest groups have power, how they compete for each other, and as a result of that, which public policies get adopted. So that's a shift I made in my thinking about it, and a shift I've continued to believe in. I believe the people who assume that voters vote their self-interest are largely assuming that voters are irrational in a certain sense, and that it's a misguided extension of the theory of rational choice that we have for consumer behavior into the political process.
But aren't you implying that democratic and non-democratic governments are identical?
Not identical, because the interest groups that may be powerful in these different governments may be different. Let me just finish this thought, and I'll try to come out to why, that they may be different, but that they're very similar in sense that the underlying structure is the power of different interest groups. That I do believe. Now, why may different interest groups be more powerful in different systems? That's not so difficult to see, although I would confess that we don't know a lot about those differences. For example, if we do have voting, and I'm an interest group that's based upon, let's say, protecting the environment. I may be maybe relatively easy for this group to influence voters in my favor than it would be for me to influence a Stalin to vote to want to protect the environment. That Stalin is one individual. The voters are a collection of individuals, each without a self-interest in what they want to do. And while everybody may be persuadable, I think the theory of rational choice says that people who are voting in situations where they don't have any direct instrumental influence over the outcome, their votes are more vulnerable to advertising and propaganda. Now, where we don't know is exactly, you know, how the precise way in which that works itself out. But in fact, if you look at, Casey Mulligan just had a paper on whether democracies or totalitarian systems spend different amounts or in different forms on Social Security, and he couldn't find any systematic relation. So maybe they are pretty similar in some ways.
But your analysis implies that totalitarian government would be more rational, because the decisions wouldn't be made by voters who have no stake in the outcome.
More rational in terms of their own interests, but the interests may be different. That's all I'm saying. More rational in the sense that you may find a well-defined group who has more power and can push outcomes, while in a democratic government you have to persuade voters to vote in your favor, and the ease of persuading them will depend upon the type of interest group involved and so on. So the outcomes will be different. It won't necessarily systematically favor always any one group. It'll be a more mixed picture.
But you said Social Security was the same in the two types.
Turned out to be the same.
But that's not.
It's not different. I don't know if we have a theory. The problem there is, about all I can, I'd be willing to say on that issue was that there have been voting theories that have claimed that Social Security would be more important under democratic governments, particularly as a function of age distribution and so on, because they took the voting model seriously and they worked out some implications. That doesn't seem to be true. A good alternative theory as to why it shouldn't make a difference, I don't think we, that's well articulated. I certainly don't feel I have it. Mulligan didn't have one in his paper. Nevertheless, I thought it was an important paper, again pointing out that basic voting models, simple or sophisticated, don't seem to work very well in explaining a lot of the important differences that we see. The challenge, a challenge I don't think has been met yet, is to have a good understanding of, the class of activities where you see significant differences and the class of activities where you don't see many differences. And I think we don't know that yet. Take a much simpler a story. Do representative systems do decentralized political democratic systems go to war more than, say, parliamentary, more centralized type of systems? Do they have different governmental policies? Do they spend more of the national income? There are economists who have been writing lately who claim there are systematic differences, and that the more centralized system, the more parliamentary type system, spend a larger fraction of their income. Now, other people have challenged that. My own belief is that that type of institution, this is within the democratic framework, it may make a difference, but it's not the crucial factor. That in both systems, you're going to find that interest groups of a very similar nature are going to rise to power. So it's no surprise that throughout Europe, and maybe to a lesser extent, but nevertheless also in the United States, environmental issues are becoming much more important, and environmental groups are becoming more powerful, that all these systems want to impose tariffs and protect domestic industries, whatever type they are. And you can go on that. They've all increased greatly in entitlement spending since the late 60s. It all started pretty much around the same time, and it's grown rapidly, more in Europe than in the United States. It's worth trying to explain. But the bigger picture is that they've all grown from really small to a huge amount. And I think that in all these systems, the larger the fraction of people are over 65, the larger the fraction of income the government spends on Social Security and so on. These are all regularities. I think they're worth trying to understand. Many of them we don't understand yet. But I have the faith that interest group analysis is going to be far more successful in understanding them, as the elderly suggest, than most of the voting models.
the emphasis that, you know, public choice theory plays on interest groups, does it work for things like explaining why we have criminal laws?
Well, it works up to a point. That is, it's not difficult to understand why we have laws against crime when a lot of the people who own human or other property are they're going to be the victims of the crime, and they will try to exert influence in whether they're numerically a majority doesn't matter. They have the resources. See, one of the things that public interest group analysis stresses is not simply numerical majorities that count, that through expenditure you can give voice to the strength of your belief. How important it is to.
By the way, it's the opposite. The larger the larger the group, the harder it is to the more serious the problem of free riding.
Oh, it is. I'm not saying large groups are better. I'm just saying that the group who are hurt by crime are a group with a lot of resources. They're willing to spend a lot to cut crime because that's would be costly to them, and that the interest group analysis stresses that you get something like a compensation principle that the compensation principle says that if you look at a public policy, then we should adopt the policies that where the amount gained by the gainers is greater than the amount lost by the losers. As a welfare criterion, one can argue about that. From a positive theory, the interest group analysis says that the gainers are going to be willing to spend up to the amount they gain, and the losers are willing to spend up to the amount they're losing in order to block such a policy. And therefore, if their power is symmetrical, you expect policies to be adopted which would have a net gain to society. Now, all these spending may be wasted resources, but you'd adopt policies that had a net gain. I think the crime has been largely an issue that the cost to society, to the many individuals of the criminal activity is great. And they, one way or another, spend a lot of resources to block it. Now, how they overcome the free rider principle? Good question. The interest group analysis doesn't have a simple or good answer for that. But that they will be willing, in the aggregate, to spend a lot is no question about that. The part about crime that puzzles me more is why, despite the rapid rise in crime we had from 60 to 80 in the United States, 20-year period, with I couldn't see any powerful interest group benefiting from that. We took very little action to stop that rise until the 80s came along, and then we began to move more in that. That has always bothered me, why it took us so long.
Well, I think part of the reason may be that the courts have been sort of taken out of the interest group process as we design institutions to resist interest group pressures.
No, and the courts are certainly an institution that's probably more resistant than most of and certainly the executive or the legislative branches, which are more directly related. That may well be that the courts not being subject to this pressure followed some theories or whatever. I'm not sure what the courts were following in this, and that. But eventually the interest groups got to them too, maybe through appointments or whatever, and you got a whole new assessment going on there.
If public choice is going to be a fruitful theory of criminal justice system, doesn't it have to be able to explain differences in criminal laws across states and across countries as a function of difference in interest group pressures,
that would be the, that would be the goal, and your question is how well does it succeed at that? I don't know.
I don't think there's any work.
Yeah, right. So I don't, that's why I say I don't know. But yes, that should be the goal. That's what you want to explain.
Yeah.
Can we do it? Well, you know, it remains to be seen when people start trying to do it. The interest group analysis has really not been applied that much to the criminal area. It's kind of interesting. I know in my own work, it was clearly a normative analysis. This is what the government should be doing, not in terms of what they did do. Now, I did try to say, well, you look at some crude properties that are more serious crimes are punished more seriously, et cetera. It seemed to be working in the right direction. But that was the extent to which I've done it. Most of the literature that I know of has followed along those lines, either doing empirical work, just looking at some effects, or asking what the government should be trying to do. I think it is a very important question to try to understand what are the laws that we get in the criminal area and how can we understand them And as I said, you know, just a few minutes ago, I've been puzzled by what happened between in the 60s and 70s, that we didn't get a quicker response. But we would want to go across countries. Why does the U.S. have capital punishment mildly, and the other countries in Europe don't have any? And a lot of other differences, I assume.
In 1981, Gary Becker published a treatise on the family, which for the first time used the tools of economic analysis to study the family as a fundamental social unit, a topic returned to in our third conversation. Why do people stay married or get divorced? How can we better understand changes in fertility rates? Why has the institution of the family changed so radically in recent decades? Other topics addressed in this third conversation include Becker's contributions to our understanding of human capital, especially in relation to education. Joining Becker for this final conversation is Edward Lazier, professor of human resources and management economics at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Gary, if you look back at the stock market crash of 1987, or look at the more recent decline in the NASDAQ, huge decline in the NASDAQ, we know that those have had big effects on physical capital, on the wealth in the economy. And yet, if you look at the economic activity that's associated with those declines, it tends to be minimal. Particularly 1987, there was almost nothing that one could see, and yet there was a 25% decline in the stock market. Similarly, right now, we have a decline in the NASDAQ that's huge, and yet really very little effect on the economy. Why is it? Why is that the case, that when we see this enormous decline in physical capital, we don't seem to see much impact on economic activity?
Yeah, I think we see in 87 essentially no impact, and now it's going to be very hard, I think, ex post to detect the impact of the stock market crash on this mild recession. I think fundamentally, if I had to give one force, the fundamental force is the great importance of human capital in the economy and the fact that movements in human capital are unrelated to movements in physical capital. So if we, as a rule of thumb, say that human capital provides about 75 to 80% of the total capital in the economy, that's what wages and salaries plus entrepreneurial income amount to, then even a 25% decline in, say, equity would only mean, let's say, a 4% or so decline in total wealth. And a 4% decline in total wealth is not going to produce any huge effects on the economy.
Well, you emphasize human capital, and that makes a lot of sense. But when we think about human capital, one of the major forms of human capital is investment in formal schooling, college education and graduate school and K-12 education. Now, does that mean that the decline in the physical capital sector will have no impact on the investment in human capital, or should it have an impact? I mean, do you think people will change their behavior in terms of wanting to go to school as a result of the current decline in the market?
Well, as you know, economists look on going to school as in large part an investment activity, that people have a cost today in terms of any tuition, and plus the time that they have to give up that they're not working, that they're spending it in school. And for most of the education, particularly the higher you go, the more important are the foregone earnings. So people contemplating continuing with school or dropping out will make two calculations. One, what's the cost of going? And what the expected benefits over their remaining lifetime? Because schooling is a capital investment that has long-lived returns. Mm-hmm. It largely takes place over one's lifetime. So now, if you look at recessions are by definition short term. Typically, they have an effect on current economic opportunities, in particular availability of jobs and the like. So let's say I'm a young person who has graduated college. I'm working a few years. My opportunities go down because banking sector is down and this sector is down. And I say, well, maybe it's a good time for me to continue my education. My costs are down because bonuses aren't so high now, maybe even I'm unemployed. Why don't I continue my education now, and by the time I finish it, let's say I take an MBA or I take a PhD or I go to law school, whatever it may be, by the time I finish, the expectation will be that this current slowdown will be over and I'll be able to get normal returns. So it's a good time to take education. And we do find, and this is one of the, I think, more interesting implications of human capital analysis, that contrary to investments in machinery and plant and in other types of physical capital, which are highly pro-cyclical, by that I mean during good times they increase enormously and during bad times they basically disappear. Human capital is just the opposite. During good times they tend to increase, particularly in some sectors, and during bad times, they tend to increase, and in good times they tend to slacken off. And that's because people are taking advantage of the greater sensitivity of the good and bad times to current costs as opposed to long-term returns. It's the comparison of benefits and costs. That's what the theory of human capital, I think, has taught economists, it's taught non-economists, that in order to try to evaluate why people go on for education, sure, there are other motives, but among the major motives are this investment component of education, that people are looking at the long-term benefits, comparing that with the cost, the sizable cost, foregone earnings being the major one for most forms of education, and they make the decision in good part on whether the benefits have risen relative to the cost or have declined relative to the cost.
All right, well, when we think about the benefits, what would be the major factor in changing the benefit side?
I think it's mainly the growth of knowledge-based technology, knowledge-based production activities that have increase the returns to all types of knowledge and information and skills. They're all, I'm going to treat them all the same thing as all as the major component of human capital, that human capital is investments in the knowledge, skills, and information of people. That's basically what it is. It's very simple. It's a fancy word describing a very simple process, but that's basically what's going on. And what's happened to the economy over the 20th century and over the last two centuries, from the beginning of the 19th century, a continuing growth in the application of knowledge to the economies. That, I think, was the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution was the first systematic attempt to apply scientific knowledge to the workings of the economy. And as it does that, it means that the workers who are more productive are increasingly workers who can command a significant amount of knowledge, general knowledge of principles and specific knowledge of particular processes.
Well, if we think about the modern economy and we compare that to the one that we were thinking about even 50 years ago, the biggest change perhaps in the modern economy is the role of women. Women have not only increased their participation in the labor market, but there's been an enormous increase in the average level of education among women as well. So what would human capital theory or what would that tell us about the increased importance of women in the market? Why is that? Is that something that's changed in the structure of the economy, the nature of the jobs are different, or is it something on the side of the family that's caused that to happen?
It's a combination of these forces. Clearly, the nature of the jobs are different, the declining role of manufacturing, growth of services, where women have been and continue to play a much more important role. That's one factor. Second factor is important changes in the family structure, so that families are smaller. Women used to be able to spend full time taking care of their children because they had four or five children. You go back to the beginning of the 20th century, the birth rates in the United States were about 3 to 4 children per family. And so then that was a full-time job, taking care of your children. Women had some education, but their education was oriented toward household activities, not toward market activities. They didn't major in engineering or economics. It was home economics, not what we would call economics, and other activities that were much more suitable for the household. That's changed drastically. Household doesn't take that much time. They have durable goods that they can help out with it. So modern women are not planning on spending most of their life taking care of children. There aren't enough children and have other ways to take care of the household activities. So they're planning for working in the marketplace. Now, in order to be productive in the marketplace, we just said you have to have more human capital. And so women have shifted, not only increasing the amount of education they have, but changing, I think it's even more important, they've changed the form of the education they have. They're investing now in market-based skills. They're majoring not in home economics, but in the same sorts of things that men major in, more or less. In MBAs, 40 or so percent of people in MBA programs are women. Medical school, a half of the enrollments are women. Law school, roughly a half overall are women. Economics PhDs, growing fraction of women. And you can see that in every single set of activities. So women are now preparing themselves in which they still will do more of the household activities, but most of the time, working time will be spent working in the market sector and not in the household sector. And therefore, they're adopting to what a modern economy is, knowledge-based. So they're getting the knowledge that will enable them to be productive in the market economy. And they are being productive. The gap between the earnings of men and women have narrowed significantly in the last 20 years.
Well, if we think about that, and we look at the effect of education, the relation of female education to the economy, we could also turn that around, and we could think about the effect of female education on the family, not the family on female education, but rather female education on the family. Now, one of the things that we observe if we look across the world is in those countries where women are educated, you tend to have the lowest birth rates. One could argue, well, that's simply a change in the culture, a change in values, but there are other ways to think about that problem. You've thought about that a whole lot over your career. And it seems to me that one of the things we ought to be focused on are what are some of the policy implications and what's the importance of educating women in terms of changing the demographics that we see occurring in the world right now.
First of all, way we would explain that would be that more educated women are good at producing sort of human capital of their children. They spend more time with them, they teach them. A lot of the teaching goes on in the home. It's easy to take the simple view that, well, you send children to school to learn, but we know that's not true. That the children are differently prepared by the time they enter school, and children who come from more educated households are much better prepared by the time they enter school, and that difference in preparation lasts with them and becomes increasingly important. So one of the crucial reasons why people coming out of less educated households often have a tough time in school and end up not getting so much education is they weren't prepared as well. So when these educated women are preparing their children much better, they're sort of substituting their time in terms of investing more in each child and as a result having fewer children. That's what economists call the quality-quantity trade-off. That's maybe not the best language, but that's what we so they have fewer children, but they invest more in each child. So that explains the association between the education of the mothers and the low fertility. Now that has public policy implications, I think, that are very striking and very important. Because we do know that one of the major sources of inequality in a modern economy is that some children get much poorer, lower quality education than other children. The question is, why is that? I think it has to start with family structure, not simply wealth, that's part of it, but also the education of the parents, especially the mothers, who are still the major specialists in child rearing and preparing their children for a productive life. And the problem facing society is how can we overcome this difference in opportunity between children coming out of less favorable families, broken families, low educated families, with children coming out of more stable families. The U.S. has been based on the principle of equality of opportunity. That's the principle that's guided our society for 200 years. It's a principle I fervently believe in. I think most people believe in the United States. When we find that principle being violated, when there's discrimination against particular minorities and so on, that bothers most Americans because it violates this principle of equality of opportunity. And therefore, the challenge is, with regard to education, how can we improve the opportunities available to children who are coming out of households where they're less well prepared? Now, that varies a lot from society to society. I've been a little bit involved in a program in Mexico called Progressor with very poor households, much poorer than what we would call the poor in the United States, who withdraw their children from school typically after 4 to 6 years of schooling, despite the fact that there are compulsory schooling laws that would mandate they spend longer in school because they can't afford to keep their kids out of school for so long. And Progressor is a program that tries to bribe the parents by offering the parents a certain amount per month for, as long as their children attend school on a regular basis and do reasonably well in it. And it's been very successful. We have evidence now that a program like Progressive has increased significantly the years of schooling obtained by these very poor families who enrolled in this program. Well, the United States doesn't have that type of poverty, but we also have to try to face more effectively than we have faced how can we improve the educational preparation and educational levels achieved by the children coming out of disadvantaged families. And I think there are a number of things we can do. I'm a strong supporter of vouchers, for example. I think the education of people in middle-class families is pretty good in the United States, even K-12, but it's not so good in the inner-city schools. And one of the reasons it's not so good is they're faced with a monopoly of the public school system. They're not, they don't have much choice. They can't afford to move to better suburbs. And vouchers and other choice-based systems give these families, even very poor families, greater choice on what school their children can attain.
Much of your work has been on the family and on population. One of the big changes in the world in recent years has been a dramatic decline in fertility rates in the Catholic countries from rates that were well above the rest of the developed world, Protestant countries like England and the United States, to a point where now those countries actually have lower fertility rates than the other countries. What's going on there? Why is that? Is it government policy? Is it changes in values, changes in culture? How would you explain that?
Well, I think the changes in fertility rates, let me go back a little bit, because I think there's a revolution going on in fertility rates in the world, and the Catholic, non-Catholic one is one aspect of that revolution. If you look in the 1950s, I have a table someplace, how many countries in 1950s had fertility rates below replacement? That is, on the average, a woman would have less than two children over her lifetime. There were three or four tiny countries, Estonia, countries like that. If you go to the 1970s, there were about 20-some countries, pretty much every one of the earlier countries, plus a whole host of new ones. If you go to the 1990s, there's almost 60 countries. About half the world's population now has fertility rates that have lower replacement. Every country in 20 years ago had it, with one minor exception, still has it. Plus, they've been joined by about 30 additional countries. So there's a population divide between half the population that has below replacement fertility, and some of these countries, like Italy, Spain, Portugal, some of the Asian countries like Japan, Korea have fertility rates that are way below replacement. So in a short period of time, maybe 10 to 20 years, their populations will begin to decline unless some significant change occurs. The other parts of the world, fertility has also come down, but it's significantly above replacement. And that would be Africa, parts of Latin America, India still, and a few other countries, Indonesia, some of the other countries. So there are two questions that I think one has to be addressed. Why this great decline in fertility? And then to come back to your question, which I think is a sub part of this question, why has the Catholic, non-Catholic differential been basically eliminated? And if anything, there's some movement the other way. The Catholics have lower fertility. Now, I don't think we have any difficulty in understanding why fertility has come down a lot in the world, there, particularly in the developed world. There are many forces associated with development that will lead to low fertility. We mentioned a few earlier that as people have become more educated, they have substituted having fewer children but having more human capital invested in their children. So in all these countries, we find, although there are variations in that, they have really few children, but they're investing much more in each child than was true in the past. Associated with that, of course, like greater labor force participation of women that we spoke about earlier. Cost of the time of women has gone up. The women's educated, more educated women who want to, again, reinforce the tendency to have fewer children and invest more in each child. Growing divorce in many countries so that people don't want to commit themselves to so many children when their marriages are much less stable. And we can go on maybe into other factors. Whether this explains the very low fertility rates, I don't think we know. but it certainly explains why there's been an enormous decline in fertility over time, why fertility is much lower now than it was even 50 years ago, let alone 100 years ago. Now, the Catholic, non-Catholic phenomena is more difficult to understand. It's found not only between countries, but also in the United States. If you look now in the United States, there's virtually no difference in fertility of Catholics and non-Catholics. Well, when I first started studying fertility, one of the important variables in any discussion was the fact that even if you hold for comparable income and comparable years of schooling, Catholics had significantly higher birth rates than non-Catholic and Protestants in the United States. No longer true. It's about the same now. It's not because Catholics' income and education is so much above that of Protestants. They're very similar on the average. There's not very little difference. I think what's happened within the Catholic population is that economic forces have trumped religion, basically. That the power of these economic forces, namely increased labor force participation of women, greater education of women, greater income, has dominated their behavior. And even though the Catholic Church has remained in its opposition to birth control techniques other than the rhythm method, to condoms and the like, even very practicing Catholics, very devout Catholics, are violating church teachings in this area.
How important is the government in determining some of these fertility patterns? Let me give you an example. Sweden is a good case. Sweden's a very modern, developed country, clearly a leader in the world in many respects. And yet, if you compare it to other countries, it actually has high fertility rates. Now, one thing that's different in Sweden is that Sweden has been very aggressive in fostering childcare programs and subsidies for parents, parental leave. Do you think that might be something that's going to affect fertility rates?
Absolutely. I think if you look at the Swedish case in the early 1930s, Sweden was one of the low fertility countries of the world. There was a great discussion in Sweden and by demographers about what explains the low Swedish fertility. Gradually, Sweden began to subsidize children. And this took off really in the 70s with two major programs. One, the fact that women who had a job and had children could take a long time off, up to a year to 18 months, and get almost full pay for all that period of time. That's an enormous subsidy. The second was a subsidy for child care activities, public child care facilities that were available to working women. And these had a significant effect. In the 70s, Swedish fertility was about equal to that of Germany's. Since the 70s, Swedish fertility has risen significantly relative to that of Germany, and Sweden has been subsidizing children much more. Now, what will happen in the future? I predict, because of the great concern in European countries and some of the Asian countries about the birth dearth, so to speak, and not enough children, that there will be growing pressure to subsidize children much more significantly in order to overcome this reluctance of parents to have enough children to even replace the populations, let alone have them growing.
When you were a young man, you were often criticized for doing research that was in some sense immoral. Immoral in the to the extent that economists shouldn't be thinking about these kinds of questions. You often put them in somewhat stark and dramatic terms. Mm. Thinking of a child as a consumer durable, for example, didn't necessarily hit everybody well. How important is morality in terms of determining economic analysis? I mean, do you find that when you're doing economic analysis, the morality creeps in?
Well, not directly. I've always been oriented toward what the Germans say for staying, understanding the world. So my economic analysis, I say of children, when I call them a consumer durable, I didn't think I was making a moral statement about that. I was making a statement about, well, this is a way to understand how many children people have, why it's changed over time, why they shift between number of children and investing in the education of children, even why the fertility rates weren't very cyclical. So they declined during bad times, but not so much. And I used a durable argument to explain why that was so. So to me, it was a way of understanding behavior. And that was true in any of the problems that I work with, family issues more generally, understanding divorce, assuming that Men and Women Maximize, why I liked polygamy as a system, why I didn't think it hurt women. These were attempts to understand. Now, it's been my strong belief that that you cannot engage in normative policy prescriptions, prescriptions about what we should be doing, what government should be doing, unless we understand how the world works. Because every intelligent policy prescription presumes there'll be certain types of responses from those people affected by these policies. And in order to understand these responses, you have to have what we call a positive analysis of how people will respond. And so I think from that point of view, one can go from a positive analysis to a policy analysis, and you base your policy analysis on the positive. So take welfare. If one believes, as I do, that if you weaken the incentives for people to work, if you weaken the incentives for people to have a stable family life, if you weaken the incentives of people to bring up their children in a way that will motivate their children to want to work hard, then you're going to find the consequence. And I think that's what welfare did. The people who advocated welfare policy didn't have what I would say was either any or the correct policy analysis. They assumed either that people don't respond to these things or that the responses are so negligible it's not worth taking into account. And I think that's where they went wrong. So I think by having a good positive analysis, we were able to be very critical of the traditional welfare program, that we could predict even before it happened that these would be the consequences of introducing a policy of that type. And I think you find the same thing whether take the voluntary army. People thought it was immoral to have a voluntary army. Economists who supported the voluntary army, and I was one of the early supporters of a voluntary army when I was a very young person, wrote a paper about the case for case against the draft. The argument was that if you went to a voluntary army, you would be able, certainly in more most normal times, to attract good quality people at relatively low prices, and that they would be good fighters, and they would be well trained, and it would give you a better armed forces than under the draft. And I think nowadays nobody denies that. You don't hear anybody saying, let me check that. You don't hear many people saying we should get rid of the voluntary army. In fact, France and Germany, long holdouts, are now going to a voluntary army because the system didn't work out for them. Russia is thinking of going to a voluntary army. Well, that's, again, an issue where issues of morality came. Do you kill patriotism by this? And we discovered you don't kill patriotism. In fact, our army is at least as patriotic as the other armies. Maybe no more so, but certainly not less so. They fight well, and they're dedicated. And this comes up in a lot of issues. Should we allow a price mechanism to be used for the purchase of organs for transplants? I'm giving a talk in Germany next week on that issue. I believe we should, because the present system just isn't working. We have long queues and growing queues, people dying, waiting for organs, only because, there's only one reason why that's due. That's because we don't allow any market in kidneys, for example, which is the most common form of transplant. So commodification, yes, but commodification is good if it leads to a more efficient allocation and a more moral outcome. Is it moral to allow people to die because they can't get an organ? To me, that's a highly immoral type of policy, which we're practicing today in the United States.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.